You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of June 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme.
Today marks the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and South China Morning Post, which is the biggest name English language paper here in Hong Kong, is not leading with it on its cover.
From lacking media coverage on the Tiananmen anniversary to Politico-style media heading to Brussels, we'll discuss the day's top news with Samira Shackle and George Brock here in the studio. Then we'll investigate the economics of the contemporary art market with Don Thompson, author of The Supermodel and the Brillo Box. And later in the programme...
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It looks just like you think.
Oh, now we're going to go in? Oy vey. You think this is a local crowd in here or regular tourists?
I don't know.
Hey! Where's everybody from?
We'll talk comedy with Bruce Dassault, editor of Beyond the Joke and critic for London's Evening Standard. All that, plus we'll say hello to our man in Milan, and there'll also be a bit of music. That's all coming up here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So as you would expect, a huge amount to cram in over the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Suzanne Chislett with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Leaders of the world's main industrial nations are arriving in Brussels for a two-day G7 summit. The meeting marks the first time in 17 years that Russia hasn't joined the US, Germany, France, Britain, Canada, Japan and Italy for a G8 meeting. They took the decision to move the venue from Sochi and to withdraw Vladimir Putin's invite following Moscow's intervention in Ukraine. The situation there and in Syria is expected to dominate the talks. Speaking at the United Nations in New York, Ukraine's UN ambassador Yuri Sergeyev insisted the country is not at civil war.
There has never been any ethnic conflict in Ukraine, and Ukrainians have always been living in peace. Ukrainians are not fighting Ukrainians. What is really happening in the eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk regions, is the ongoing counter-terrorist operation exclusively against large groups of mercenaries, subverts, terrorists and criminals, majority of whom come from Russia and their military commanders are Russian citizens.
The United States has increased the amount of aid pledged to help Syria's neighbors cope with the millions of refugees fleeing the ongoing conflict there. Secretary of State John Kerry made the announcement as he visited Lebanon, one of the nations hosting the displaced.
$290 million in humanitarian assistance for those affected by the conflict, both inside Syria and the communities throughout the region where they have taken refuge. With the newest contribution that I've announced today, the United States has now committed more than $2 billion to support refugees and the nations that have opened their doors to them.
Mr. Kerry's visit comes as a former American ambassador to Syria criticizes the White House for not doing more sooner to help rebels fighting the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. He is widely expected to win another term in office when the results of yesterday's widely condemned elections are known. Pakistan's biggest city has been in lockdown for a second day following the detention in London of the leader of the party which controls it. MQM head Altaf Hussain has been receiving hospital treatment since his arrest on money laundering charges. Although he's lived in the UK for more than 20 years, the political party he leads governs Karachi, a city of 18 million. Shops and markets remain closed amid fears there could be violence. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in Hong Kong for the only major commemoration in China of the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. It was one of the biggest turnouts at the annual vigil for several years. While no mention is made of the anniversary on Chinese media, in Hong Kong, which was a British colony at the time, vigils have been held in remembrance every year. This office worker says for the first time, pro-Beijing groups were also present.
Well, this is a freedom of speech. Everyone has their right to speak for themselves. But if you're trying to be here where there are more than thousands of people speaking their voice and you stand here, I think you're trying to create troubles. And that's why we have lots of police surrounding them.
The US Army says the sergeant freed by the Taliban after 5 years in captivity is continuing to make progress. Bo Bergdahl's being treated at a military hospital in Germany. The insurgents have released a video showing his handover to American forces on Saturday. The Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has been called to appear before a leading congressional committee to explain the decision to do a deal to secure his freedom. And Germany's army is to get a multi-million euro makeover. The country's defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, wants it to compete better with civilian businesses. Now there's no conscription. She has revealed a 100 million euro plan to improve childcare facilities, internet access and barracks, as well as introducing more flexible working hours and stopping the practice of moving personnel around so often. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne Chislett, thank you very much indeed. 1806 in London, 1306 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's Wednesday, it's Midori House. Welcome. Joining me today with their take on the news here in the studio is Samira Shackle, a London-based journalist, and George Brock, head of the journalism department at City University. Samira and George, welcome to you both. We're going to start by looking at the 25th anniversary of the deadly crackdown in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Samira and George will talk to you both in just one moment, but first let's hear from our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, who earlier today flipped through some of the Asian newspapers to see how they're covering it from her part of the world. Here's Aisha.
Today obviously marks the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre or crackdown, depending on how you want to phrase it. And South China Morning Post, which is probably the biggest name, it's not the most widely circulated, but the biggest name English language paper here in Hong Kong, is not leading with it on its cover. Instead, it's leading with a story, which is a very Hong Kong story, on a drop in retail sales, which has been the biggest in 5 years. Similarly, the Hong Kong Standard, which is a free paper that's given out, very widely read in Hong Kong, quite good journalism in it often, but it's a smaller, more tabloidy kind of paper. That's similarly leading with the retail sales drop story. Both papers reference the Tiananmen Square situation and anniversary on their third pages. And in the South China Morning Post, it's talking about how support for the Tiananmen vindication is slipping and saying that there's a kind of greater level of apathy amongst people in terms of remembering it. On the opinion pages in the South China Morning Post, there is quite a big piece written by a Hong Konger about that and about Hong Kong identity in itself. Ming Pao, which is one of the most widely read and respected Chinese language dailies here, is leading with a big piece on the anniversary on its front page. It's got a whole banner designed for it. Lots of pictures of what's going to be happening in Victoria Park this evening, where thousands of Hong Kongers will go and hold a candlelight vigil. The police are already there. There's been some scuffles between pro-Beijing and not-so-pro-Beijing people at the local MTR station. And online, South China Morning Post is really covering it. I think it's tomorrow where we'll see big front-page coverage, big photos, full-bleed photos of the candlelight vigil.
Aisha Spears there in Hong Kong. George Brock, 25 years ago, the South China Morning Post was far braver. They ran pictures, big banner headlines about the butchery, as they called it, in Beijing. A lot has changed, and not necessarily for the better.
Well, firstly, it isn't quite so much news as it was, because what the Chinese authorities have done is create a situation by force and coercion in which there is nothing happening. So there is almost nothing for, strictly speaking, news media to get at. But the other weird thing about these kinds of situations is you do have an enormous amount of remembering going on. It just isn't going on in mainstream media. Somebody said today, I think from Hong Kong, you know, there is absolutely nothing going on Chinese social media, on Weibo or WeChat, but there is masses going on in Twitter. And she said, actually, that's now where the border is. That's the border around the Chinese. And it's a tragedy that they have managed to suppress everybody's attempts to remember it in China, but actually it is being remembered outside. It may just not be very prominent in mainstream journalism because there isn't much to say until you've got pictures of things like candlelight vigils, which are just symbolic. They're not like the news of the massacre itself.
Samira Shackle, a number of people that have been involved, that were involved in the protest 25 years ago, say that, you know, if they'd been asked 25 years ago, in a quarter of a century's time, not only will these same people still be in power, but will this massacre not even be actually remembered, not even be allowed to be remembered? They said they would have been shocked by that. They would have thought that at least something would have changed.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, actually. I mean, when you think about that, the fact that it's more than two decades, and at the time people were saying that the party couldn't withstand it, not in its form at the time, then I think it's quite astonishing, really, as a fact that it's managed to do that. And I think that there's something quite interesting there about the effect of censorship on collective memory. So I think that, obviously, as you've both said, that it is being remembered privately by people who are involved in it, by the families of those who were lost. But something that really struck me in the reports I was reading was that some of the young censors who are have been employed to remove evidence of the protests from the internet and to censor the web don't actually recognise the pictures that they're censoring because, if they're sort of 22, 23, 24, then it's something that has been suppressed from the moment they were born. So it's quite an interesting lesson in that sort of complete mode of censorship where people don't actually know anymore that they're being censored. And I think that's what you see generally, certainly with China's censorship of the web and I think elsewhere.
And that, George, is one of the astonishing things about this, what censorship over such a long period of time does, is that iconic image that the rest of us know of, you know, the man standing in front of the tank and the tank tries to move left and the man moves left and the tank tries to move right and the man moves right. And it's actually, in a weird sense, quite amusing to watch this tank try and get past this lone man.
One of the reasons we remember it so well is that it's funny.
Yes, exactly. And yet this is an image that actually, for a lot of Chinese people, they won't have seen.
They won't, but nevertheless, we have an enormous ability to capture and store images, much greater than it used to be, actually. And I don't think one should, however long they have managed to suppress it, and it's dreadful that they have, it isn't going to completely disappear from the rest of the world. And history tells us that massive though their attempt to wall off their population from knowledge is, these attempts don't last forever. It really is incredibly difficult to do it forever. It is extraordinary that they've done it for 25 years, and they clearly intend to keep doing it. But actually, in the really long run, it probably won't work.
And interesting as well, Samira, that, you know, despite the fact that there isn't much coming out of China's day about Tiananmen, the very fact that still 25 years on, the authorities feel like they have to crack down, and they have on foreign media, on local independent media, on even allowing anyone to walk into the square today, shows that they understand how big a symbol this still is.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's certainly an awareness of the symbolism of Tiananmen, but I do think it's very interesting on that sort of censorship thing. I remember speaking to a friend who lived in Beijing for a few years, who had some sort of friends who were students there, and showing them on his iPad a picture of Tiananmen, and they were saying, "Oh, what's that? Is it from a movie? Is it fake?" And so just not believing that it was something that was real. So I think there's certainly an awareness that it could have huge symbolic power, but I think for the young generation, it would take such a level of sort of explanation and challenge to so many things that they've believed to be true for their whole lives that it will take quite a breakthrough for activists, I think.
And finally on this issue, George Brock, were something similar to happen in China today, given the advances in technology, do you think it would be much harder for the Chinese authorities to keep a lid on it, or is that overly optimistic?
I think that you've got to be very, very careful about assuming that digital technology always flows in, as it were, a liberating, plural, informing direction. It's incredibly easy to conduct surveillance on people using digital technology. It's quite easy to manipulate. It's even possible to stop it. You can assume, I think, surely we can imagine that the Chinese authorities have thought about precisely the question you've just asked. What happens if somebody does get out of control, somewhere big and symbolic, like even perhaps Tiananmen Square, and they attempt to reproduce a demonstration of that kind, and everybody's taking images of it on their mobile phones, what are they going to do? Well, they will try and shut down a lot of communications. But actually, that will mean that there is more information captured and it will seep out. So in the end, again, now it is more difficult for them to do that kind of thing. That suppression was easier in 89.
Let's move now to Egypt, where despite technology, suppression seems to be going full steam ahead. Both the White House and the British Foreign Secretary have today announced that they're looking forward to working with the country's new president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Samira Shackle, they've been quite careful in the language they've used. The White House hasn't congratulated Mr. Sisi on his election victory in the way that they did with Mohamed Morsi. William Hague has said he's looking to Sisi to take steps to implement the rights contained in Egypt's constitution by opening up political space, especially with regard to freedom of expression and association. So perhaps for those of us that would wish for a bit more freedom and openness in Egypt, the right words. But will it make any difference?
I don't think so. I think there's certainly a level of pragmatism demonstrated here in the fact that, you know, Egypt's a very important regional ally to the West. And so that's why I think they're sort of at every step have sort of said that they're willing to work with Sisi, really. And I think are quite reluctant to condemn in strong terms certain abuses of human rights and to apply pressure. I think the reluctance to apply pressure is also partly due to the fact that there's quite a strong anti-Western sentiment in Egypt at the moment, and that the government has been actively looking towards other sort of allies in the Gulf and so on. So might not continue to be quite so reliant on Western aid, for example. But I think that they couldn't really not acknowledge that there were a lot of flaws with the election. I think it was the president of Democracy International, who was one of the main international monitoring groups in Egypt, said that it was impossible to have a genuinely democratic election given the very restrictive political environment. And I think that's certainly true. When the space for opposition, both the Islamist and the secular opposition, is so small, it's very difficult to have the robust public debate that you need for a genuinely democratic election.
And George, the US, in their statement, spoke about looking forward to working with Sisi to advance a strategic partnership and many interests shared by the US and Egypt. And, you know, this has been a delicate game for the US to play since, you know, it first looked like Mubarak might fall, because for all the warm words of democracy, the US did see Egypt as a very useful ally in the region. And when we say Egypt, we really mean the Egyptian military.
I don't think we should go all soggy with sympathy, but there is occasional moments where you can feel a little bit sorry for diplomats and politicians. We want them to be idealistic, but they have to deal with the facts on the ground. I actually think these statements contain quite a lot of threat in them. They have allowed themselves room later to say, look, we may once have tolerated the Egyptian military, we may once have given you vast amounts of aid, but sorry, it's changed. You don't have the legitimacy. We're going to cut down the aid gradually, and we're just going to take less notice of you guys.
Well, that's what the words might say, and I think you're right in that it's...
Well, they might imply it, imply it.
But it's certainly different from, you know, the way that previous dictators have been dealt with, or indeed, in fact, some other dictators in the Middle East, be they in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia. The US and the UK are both still quite happy to be very nice to. But having said all that, you know, is the US going to stop giving Egypt's military $1.5 billion of aid every year? That's unlikely to stop, isn't it?
It's unlikely to stop dead, because those things practically never do stop dead. But I think they have started to open the question in Washington about whether that's really a good idea in the long run. After all, it was partly an investment in the fact that Egypt didn't take a completely static, rigid view of Israel. Well, a lot will depend on what part Egypt can play in the wider Middle Eastern questions. If they become irrelevant to the wider Middle Eastern questions, which I suspect is what's happened to them in the last couple of years, eventually some hard-headed politician, it might not be Obama, in Washington, is going to say, what are we getting out of all this? Not much, I'd say. Let's spend less.
And Samira, just finally on this point, do you expect the Brits and the Americans to perhaps be leaning on Egypt a little bit and saying, look, give us a small victory, release the Al Jazeera journalists, or perhaps pardon some of those that you've sentenced to death for the alleged murder of one policeman? Do you think that those sorts of things might be what diplomats here in Washington might be sort of at least hoping they can use to gloss over some of the other issues?
I'm sure, and I'm sure a lot of that pressure is already being applied with limited success, I'd say. But I think that that sort of pressure and the idea that aid it could be contingent on this roadmap to democracy, which is something that the White House has already said, was evident in Egypt's military's attempts to ensure a high turnout. They wanted an 80% turnout, but I think says quite a lot the means they took to get that turnout, which was sort of threatening to fine people who didn't vote, extending the vote for a third day when the turnout wasn't high
enough,
and so
on. You're not a true national unless you actually vote. Samira Shackle, George Brock, we'll leave it there for a moment. We'll be back in a minute, and we'll be talking about the US in Somalia, Politico in Brussels, and possibly one or two other things as well. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, George Brock and Samira Shackle. Let's turn now to Pakistan. And yesterday here in London, Altaf Hussain, the leader of one of Pakistan's most powerful parties, was arrested in a money laundering investigation. Hussain runs the MQM party, and he had sought asylum here in the UK in the early 1990s. Samira, there's obviously been a lot of reaction in Pakistan over the last 24 hours to Hussain's arrest. Are you surprised that he's been arrested now, given that, there had been talk before about whether he should be arrested or not, and both the UK and Pakistani authorities, despite, some concerns over him, had perhaps thought, well, it might not be the best thing in the world to arrest him?
Well, I think the investigation's been going on for a long time, so in some ways it's not that surprising. I think it's true. I mean, it's quite specifically in Karachi that this is an issue, and that's where the MQM is most powerful. That's the sort of biggest city in Pakistan. It's the economic hub. It's very, very volatile, and the MQM tend to dominate there. And so since it's been announced that there's been the city's shut down, basically, I spoke to friends and relatives and former colleagues there. And within hours, the streets were completely jammed. People couldn't get home. And we're now into the second day of shutdown. People are running out of essential goods like fuel, petrol. And I think there has been a reluctance in the past to arrest Altaf Hussain because of this idea that Karachi, which is a very volatile city, which was in sort of subsumed by violent street wars in the 1990s, which was largely led by the MQM, the sense that Karachi could go up in flames, essentially. We haven't seen that yet. It's been a shutdown, but it's been sort of in Karachi terms relatively peaceful thus far, but it's sort of uncertain how long it's going to go on for.
George, do you think a number of people watching this will be trying to work out whether it might be more sensible to try and find some sort of face-saving way out if the threat of something more than a shutdown emerges?
Well, I would have thought that probably all that thinking went on ahead of his arrest. I mean, as Samira just said, this didn't come suddenly. It came on the back of years of investigation of the MQM in Britain, one of those parties which had generally kind of been tolerated here until it started to get difficult and more allegations were made. One of its leading members was killed in 2000 and murdered in England in 2010. And the police have obviously had to take more and more interest in it. And I would have thought they would have been pretty reluctant and probably held back from doing what they were doing until it really became impossible to do anything else. So I would have thought now the wheels grind on.
We will see how that develops. Samira, I just also wanted to ask you, you've just come back from Kenya where you've been working on some stories about Somalia. Somalia is about to welcome its first US ambassador in more than 20 years. The US has been without an envoy there since just before, in fact, the Black Hawk Down incident in 1993, pretty much since the country fell apart in 1991. We've seen in recent years The UN have had a presence back in Somalia. Turkey opened an embassy 2 years ago. The Brits opened an embassy last year, although it's inside the airport compound and they never go outside. But a sign perhaps that things are improving slowly but surely in Somalia.
I think it's certainly an improvement. I think that perhaps a year ago, people were talking a lot more confidently about a regeneration in Mogadishu than they are now. There's certainly been a lot of attacks, and it's just something I noticed. As you said, I've been working on stories about Somalia. I was supposed to be going to Mogadishu last week, and then there was a huge bomb attack on the parliament.
So not that
it's
safe.
It's not that safe is the thing. And it, you know, there's something every week in the Western press, and that's a gross underreporting of what actually happens, of the sort of attacks on state targets, on foreign targets and so on. And also outside Mogadishu, sections of the country are complete chaos. But I think there's a slow improvement, and I think it's a sort of that the US ambassador, I think, will be based in Nairobi and going back and forth. And I think it's a nod towards the fact that things are very slowly getting better and building up to the first election in 2016. It's a sort of statement of intent, I think.
George, previously the leading US official for Somalia wasn't called an ambassador, but the leading official would have been based in Nairobi. We've had a very nice house in Mathaga where all the top diplomats live. It's very lovely around there. Going to Mogadishu is going to be, even if they are in and out, it's going to be a different beast, isn't it?
There isn't going to be a queue around the State Department building for the job, I don't think, no.
No, quite. And just finally, before we go, Politico, which is the big American insider politics website / newspaper. It's made Washington very, very sexy, or as sexy as it can possibly be. It appears to be trying to do the same thing to a part of the world which you'd think anyone would struggle to make appear sexy, Brussels. George Brock, how on earth can anyone make Brussels exciting?
Once upon a time, Tom, I earned my living trying to do that. I can't wait for a high-velocity online politics website to try its hand at doing this. But the problem is, it's not a place where power is concentrated. It's dispersed between Brussels and the capitals, and partly Brussels has advanced by trying to be boring and not controversial. It's an incredibly difficult place to see, but it's going to be a really fascinating experiment. I do hope the story's true.
And Samira, what's interesting is this is a time where Brussels is being covered less and less by European newspapers. The number of full-time correspondents in Brussels is reducing every single year. Those that are there tend to go to the rather dull midday briefings and go back to their offices and then write about that. And yet there could be, I mean, this is, you know, a lot of stuff goes on there that affects, you know, 450 million people across the continent. Perhaps Politico going in there and shaking it up is what it needs.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I mean, lots of people said that the Washington news market was already completely saturated and it didn't need anything else. And Politico did sort of manage to disprove that and find a big constituency of people who are very excited by this. So, I mean, I guess if anyone can do it, they can.
Indeed. We'll leave it there. Samira Shackle and George Brock, thank you both for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost, se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Much still to come in the second half hour here on Midori House. We'll be in Milan, we'll be in Toronto, and we'll also talk comedy. But first, here's Suzanne Chislett with the world headlines.
Thank you, Steve. Leaders of the world's main industrial nations are arriving in Brussels for a two-day summit. The meeting marks the first time in 17 years that Russia hasn't joined the G7 nations. They took the decision to withdraw Vladimir Putin's invite because of Moscow's intervention in Ukraine. Earlier, President Obama met the incoming Ukraine leader Petro Poroshenko for talks. He promised his support as the new government tries to return the country to peace. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in Hong Kong for the only major commemoration in China of the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. It was one of the biggest turnouts at the annual vigil for several years. Pakistan's biggest city, Karachi, has been in lockdown for a second day following the detention in London of the leader of the party which controls it. The arrest of MQM head Altaf Hussein on money laundering charges has angered many in Karachi. And the US Army says the sergeant freed by the Taliban after 5 years in captivity is continuing to make good progress. Bo Bergdahl is being treated at a military hospital in Germany. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Suzanne, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. 21:32 in Moscow, 19:32 in Milan, 18:32 in London. Time now for us to head to Milan. From Venice's arrested mayor to Matteo Renzi's 100 days in office, 100 days so far, obviously. Ivan Cavallo is here to give us a rundown of all we need to know. Ivan, welcome to Midori House. Let's begin in Venice, where the mayor has been arrested. Tell us why.
Yeah, the arrest of the Venice mayor is related to the project, the so-called Moses Project, which is an infrastructure project in the lagoon to prevent flooding during high tides. As everybody knows, when there's those bad weather reports, there's usually images of Venice and St. Mark's Square and people sitting on tables as the waters come up and flood the streets of Venice. And this project has been going on for a very long time. It's a very expensive multi-billion-dollar project to build these gates to prevent the flooding. And there's been a scandal that's been revealed. The magistrates, prosecutors have found what they believe, they allege that the 25 million euros have been paid to politicians that have gone to help their political campaigns, bipartisan, because we're looking at politicians from both, for example, the mayor is from Matteo Renzi's party. But there's talk now of possibly the former governor of the Veneto region, who was also minister of Berlusconi's party, being involved in this. So it's another, just after last month's scandal in the Expo, the World Expo being built in Milan. Again, Italy's in the headlines for corruption.
And it also comes really at a terrible time. I mean, not that there's ever a good time for a corruption scandal to break, but, you know, all the world's architectures and designers, anyone who really cares about those things, are about to arrive in Venice because it's the Architecture Biennale.
Yeah. The timing was bad. Even last month, there was the one-year countdown for the World's Fair that Milan's going to host next year, and there were these arrests that were made. So, unfortunately, the big problem that's always been nagging Italy of corruption has reared its head again, and it's something that the country has to tackle. And it's a problem that, you know, the EU commissioners have talked about. There was that recent anti-corruption report about. There were estimates saying Italy was half of the 120 billion euros that cost of corruption in Europe was Italy. There was questions about the figures, but obviously it is a loss. An Italian taxpayer would tell you even 1 euro is too much, because this is going into pockets of politicians to pay for their campaigns, and people are well and tired of it.
Let's talk now about a more popular politician. Matteo Renzi has now had 100 days in office.
One of the main criticisms of Mr. Renzi was that no one had elected him. He was the third choice, or the third person from the PD since the last election to lead the party. But he has now a bit of a mandate. He was one of the biggest winners in the European elections, getting 40% of the vote, brushing off the challenge from Beppe Grillo. Is he, I assume, riding high and in a rather good mood?
Indeed, he is in a good mood. And, you know, it is interesting because people were talking about, low turnout in the European elections. And the Italians tend to turn out in good numbers. Italy was founding member of the EU project back in the 50s. 50% of voters came out. So that's pretty high. If you look at Germany, Spain, France, they're well below. They're like 10, 12 points below. And that 20-point difference between him and Beppe Grillo was quite interesting, quite surprising, but he was able to break away, and that 40% sort of mark was really key. And a lot of people said he's able to bring people who, a lot of people dissatisfied, obviously, we've just been talking about corruption, for example, but this campaign of hope and change and reform, and it's drawn voters to him. And he now has a mandate because he was, of course, in a very Machiavellian sort of coup brought in. He basically eliminated Letta, a fellow member of the PD, and basically took over the third member of the third caretaker government after Monti and Letta. But now he has this mandate, and he's hoping when Italy hosts the EU presidency for the last 6 months of 2014 to sort of ride this momentum and try to do some projects.
Let's turn now to airlines and airports. Alitalia may finally be saved. Etihad is riding to the rescue. What can we expect?
Yeah, after it's now over 5 months of this dance on the table, due diligence, it looks like Abu Dhabi carrier is going to put down some money into Alitalia. Of course, with the EU regulations, they can't have a majority, so it'll be a 49% stake, but it's something that Alitalia desperately needs right now. I mean, Italy, of course, the key tourist market. And with a national carrier that hasn't been able to make money, they're looking for a savior because Matteo Renzi's government said we're not picking out the carrier again. There was a bailout last year under Letta, and so it looks like they will get this €500 million. Of course, for Etihad, it's they're looking at their interest too, so they're going to want to probably funnel some traffic through Abu Dhabi, flights going from Europe to Asia. And maybe some of the Milan airports might be penalized over Rome as a hub. So there is some tension right now about that in Milan.
Indeed. So there will be some discussion about which airports get the bulk of this business, won't there?
Yeah, because in Milan we have two airports. We have a city airport, Linate and Malpensa, which was supposed to be the intercontinental hub, and now it's really the hub of no one because Alitalia pulled out when they're having problems before. And so now, for example, if you have to fly to Beijing for work, there's only a flight on Air China. A lot of travelers for business have to go through Frankfurt, Paris, Rome, or through some of these places like Istanbul now with Turkish Airlines. And Abu Dhabi is looking at strategies to funnel traffic through. They've obviously made investments in other carriers in Europe, Air Berlin, Darwin. So they're looking to beef up for their own network and not an alliance system. So. In Milan, people are a bit concerned because next year we have the World's Fair, as we mentioned before. So making sure there's enough flights in to bring these potential visitors to the fair.
Ivan Cavallo in Milan, thank you very much indeed. Up next, we're in Toronto to look at the economics of auctions. You're listening to Midori House.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen.
The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. The economics of the international art market has often been a mystery to outsiders, with a small group of power dealers, inflated sky-high price tags, and the appearance at times of a massive bubble. The art world often seems like the Wild West. In a new book by The Economist professor and author Don Thompson, the inner workings of the world of art and auctions are revealed. It's called The Supermodel and the Brillo Box, named after two such works of art. And Don joins us now on the line from Monocle's Toronto Bureau. Don Thompson, welcome to Midori House.
Hello, Steve.
The Supermodel and the Brillo Box, we'll get on to who those characters are first, but reading this book and looking at the way you write about this world, you manage to sort of look at the sort of the fantastically bizarre nature of it, but it's not written with a sneer, is it? This is, you know, you are genuinely fascinated in how this world works, aren't you?
Oh, very much. You know, you all of your listeners, I'm sure, see in the front page of papers three or four times a year record prices being brought for contemporary art. Art by artists who are still alive and still producing, and yet they're bringing $50 million at auction. And as an economist, my question is why? Why are things selling at 100 times what I think they might sell at? And so I set out this and a previous book to try and answer that question. And there are some fascinating answers.
And it's interesting as well that, you know, this book, your second one, is written obviously after the financial crash of 2008 and beyond. And what was astonishing about what the impact the crash had on the art market was actually at the top end, very little.
The top end, very little, because it is being propped up by about 100 museums around the world, which are buying about one museum quality work of contemporary art a day for new collections. The museum would like to open with about 2,000 works of art. And there are a couple of museums, one in Qatar and one in Abu Dhabi, which have annual acquisition budgets greater than the top 25 American museums combined, with the exception of the Getty in Los Angeles. So enormous amounts of money.
Indeed, and often enormous amounts of money for, and I don't want to get into a sort of, oh, contemporary art, it's all, I could do that, and it's all just nonsense. But the two examples you use for the title, The Supermodel and the Brillo Box, could be considered exactly that. The Brillo Box is literally a box full of Brillo pads, isn't it?
Well, the Brillo Box was symbolic of Andy Warhol's making industrial art legitimate. And so Brillo boxes that were made for Warhol or approved by Warhol are very valuable, in excess of $600,000. Whereas those which were made at the same time but not approved by Warhol are worth $100.
And the supermodel in question, you ask early on in the book, you know, why would an art collector pay $2.5 million or $2.4 million for this a nude waxwork of someone else's wife, when the same amount might buy a Monet or a Picasso, or as you describe it, an actual trophy wife. What sort of answer do you end up finding in this?
Well, contemporary art has a unique position now in the acquisition strategies of very rich people. And to really comprehend what's happening, you have to understand how rich, very rich people are. The supermodel is a statue which is modeled after a gazelle that had been shot by the supermodel's husband, whose name is Peter Brandt. It arches from the wall. Her breasts are discreetly covered by her hands. It's made by the people who make wax objects for Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. It has human hair, it has artificial eyes, it has makeup. The hair goes down to the waist and is intended to be, you're supposed to have a stylist come in once a month and redo it according to the mood of the room and the mood of the people. Formal, informal, and or pigtails or so on. Now, this was bought for $2.4 million, actually by a gentleman named Jose Mangrabi, who is a friend of the couple. So, you know, you can ask yourself your male listeners could ask their spouses what they think if he brought home a nude model of a friend's wife for $2.4 million. But that sort of thing that goes on in the contemporary art world and is detailed in the book.
Do you buy art yourself?
I do, not at all on the scale of what I discuss in the book. And I buy things I love and that touch me. And
what sort of art? And where do you buy from?
Very diverse. I've lived in half a dozen different countries in my life, and I have samples of art from each of those. Just things I've encountered that have good memories that I want to wake up in the morning and see. There's no pattern to it, and I'm not sure they're particularly valuable.
And having researched and written these two books about some of the lunacy of the top end of the art market, has it diminished at all your love for art and the art world, or for the characters involved in it?
Not at all. The book is really about the backstories that accompany expensive art. Any art that sells, and the book is about the top 1/100th of 1% of the auction market. Think of over $5 million at auction for a work of contemporary art. And all of those works come with backstories of what the artist was thinking and what he meant and the role it played in his life and who's owned it. And often the stories are invented by the dealer because the art has to have backstory, sometimes by the auction house. Tracking those down, talking to the artists, putting together why things sell for $50 million is fascinating, and it's as fascinating now as when I started the book.
And is it one of those things that once you start pulling at that thread and say, well, hang on, why is this worth $50 million? Does it all start to fall apart, or do at the end you think, oh, actually, no, I can understand why this was worth so much?
Well, again, you have to start with a focus on how much money really wealthy people have. This, in many cases, people are paying 4 or 5 days income for the art they're buying. And you would pay 4 or 5 days income for a work of art that you loved, and so will they. Now, sometimes they're buying it as an investment, and that's a more interesting question, because it would have to double in value in 6 or 7 years to make a good investment. But, you know, everyone has their own motivation.
Everyone does indeed. Don Thompson, author of the new book, The Supermodel and Brillo Box, thank you very much for joining us from our Toronto Bureau, 1849 here in London. A bit of music now. This is Felt with Primitive Painters. Felt with Primitive Painters on Monocle 24. Time now to end the show with a little bit of a chat about comedy. We're joined by Bruce Dessault, editor of the comedy website Beyond the Joke and critic for London's Evening Standard. Bruce, welcome to Midori House. We want to start with a return. Is it a return for Jerry Seinfeld? Can we call it a return?
Yes, I think people you know, what people really want Jerry Seinfeld to do is another series of Seinfelds, which was one of the most successful sitcoms of all time. But what he is, he doesn't need the money. He's one of the richest comedians in the world. So he's decided to do comedy online instead. And he's launched a series. I mean, this is the fourth, it's now about to return to its fourth series, so it's also doing very well, called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Which is exactly what it says.
Let's hear a little promo of it before we talk more.
Here's a peek at the new season of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with my very special guests, George Wallace, Aziz Ansari, Sarah Jessica Parker, Robert Klein, and Jon Stewart.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It looks just like you think.
Oh, now we're going to go in? Oy vey. You think this is a local crowd in here or regular tourists?
I don't know.
Hey! Where's everybody from?
Texas! Vegas.
North Dakota!
Is it actually funny, Bruce?
Yes, I mean it is. I mean, you have to get on the same wavelength as them. But I mean, he's had such good guests. And obviously because it's online, you can look at old episodes anytime you like. He's had some great guests in the past. He's had people like Ricky Gervais. Obviously, it depends what you think of Ricky Gervais. He's had Louis C.K., who is very funny. Larry David, who helped to create the Seinfeld sitcom. And it's a similar sense of humor. It's a very laid-back, almost improvised. It's not tightly, doesn't seem very tightly scripted. And as I said, it does what it says on the tin. They drive in one of. It's also very good if you're interested in cars, because Jerry Seinfeld has a fantastic vintage car collection. Right. Each episode features he drives a different vintage car.
I'm sure the car comedy crossover is large. Let's talk now about Amar Rachman. Before we hear a clip of him, Bruce, tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's interesting. He's a Bengali Australian comedian, and you don't get many of those. He's been to the UK before as part of a double act, which is called Fear of a Black Planet, and now he's set out on his own as a solo comedian. He was actually he's a young guy, and he actually had decided he was thinking of giving up stand-up comedy, but then he put out this clip of a 3-minute routine about his views on racism, and it went viral. It's called Reverse Racism, so you can find that online.
It went
so viral, he decided to go back to stand-up comedy and do a solo show.
Let's hear that that little clip right now.
If you ask some black and brown people, they'll tell you flat out there is no such thing as reverse racism. I don't agree with that. I think there is such a thing as reverse racism, and I could be a reverse racist. If I wanted to, all I would need would be a time machine, right? And what I'd do is I'd get in my time machine, I'd go back in time to before Europe colonized the world, right? And I'd convince the leaders of Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Central and South America to invade and colonize Europe, right? Just occupy them, steal their land and resources, set up some kind of like, I don't know, trans-Asian slave trade where we exported white people to work on giant rice plantations in China. Just ruin Europe over the course of a couple of centuries so all their descendants would want to migrate out and live in the places where black and brown people come from. But of course, in that time, I'd make sure I set up systems that privilege black and brown people at every conceivable social, political, and economic opportunity.
So yeah, you can see why that took fire and why it's made him decide to return to stand-up.
Yeah, it kind of touched a nerve. It's a sort of classic, you know, it's political, but it's also very funny and very clever. And so he's coming to Soho. He's making his solo debut in London next week. He's at the Soho Theatre from the 10th to the 21st of June.
Okay, and then just finally, the BBC, which likes to think it does comedy pretty well and sometimes does, has just launched a new series of one-off online comedy programmes. Before we talk about that, Bruce, let's hear this clip. It's of Frankie Boyle and Bob Mortimer, bizarre combination, attempting to present an informative cookery show.
What is it? Red light going off then, Bob?
Let me explain. That is a viewer feedback warning light to let us know if we're reaching the required quota of social media buzz and fun.
I'm looking inside myself and I'm struggling to care about that.
No, I can tell that, Frankie. But this hot pot sounds delicious, so off you go.
You're going to need a neck of lamb, some potatoes, carrots and peas. There's a little green light now.
Yep. Now that is a different viewer response buzzer light. That indicates that that list of ingredients that you just gave was a potentially informative bridge in the show.
Bob Mortimer there with Frankie Boyle. Bruce, the fact that all this is online rather than on TV, does that mean it's online because it's not very good or because that's where comedians can be a bit more inventive?
It's more of the second than the first. I mean, there are six of these, and they are a bit of a hit and miss. There's a very funny one with Mickey Flanagan. There are others that aren't quite so good. But what the BBC is not stupid. It's funny that that clip was about marketing, because what the BBC is doing is they're putting some of their star names. They're giving them a chance to make a type of show that they've always wanted to do. I think that was the brief. They said to Bob Mortimer, what have you always wanted to do? And he said a cooking programme with Frankie Boyle. So he got to make it.
But right. I somehow can't quite believe that was his lifetime ambition. But there we are. Bruce Dassault, I'm afraid we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we've got time for on today's programme. My thanks in particular to our special guests, George Brock and Samira Shackle. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello. The studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after a full bulletin, is The Entrepreneurs, presented by Daniel Giacopelli. And then at 2200 hours London time, it's The Monocle Daily. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
At Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.